Hi, I'm Tara, and welcome to Sagas and Sass Season 4, brought to you by Geek Saga Entertainment. This is Episode 83, continuing our coverage of Lightbringer, the sixth installment in Pierce Brown's Red Rising saga.
I'm fellow Sagas and Sass host Jonathan. This episode is titled Aftermath, and we'll be discussing Virginia, Lysander, and Darrow's POVs through Chapter 36 in Rampart, Part 2 of Lightbringer.
And I'm regular guest host Seth, here to remind you that our Red Rising coverage is spoiler-free outside of the chapters we cover in each episode.
That said, don't forget that the opinions are those of us as individuals and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the show as a whole. But let's be real, usually we're all on the same page or very close to it.
Last but not least, don't forget to check out our Patreon. With 10 tiers ranging from $1 a month to $40 a month, it offers tons of ways to support us and receive some great perks in return. You can find us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment. With that, it's time to visit the aftermath of the Battle of Phobos.
Victra might have returned triumphant, but after 2 weeks of fighting over Phobos, Virginia is meeting with Lysander for a parley. And seeing him, she comes to the unfortunate realization the young man in front of her is not a spoiled, entitled princeling. I beg to differ, but that's okay.
I'm with him.
They exchange barbs, but ones that are focused on Darrow, Lysander's previous encounter with him, his current absence, and the giant statue of him that reigns over Phobos. Unfortunately for Virginia, the most pressing matter right now is that Lysander has her by the proverbial balls. But thankfully, some of the Rat Legion is about an idea that does, in fact, bother Lysander. In the end, though, Atalantia is probably the bigger problem for both of them, and this is what truly led them to meet with each other. Both of their forces are bleeding over Phobos, when the real prize is Mars, and so Virginia agrees to give up the moon for a chance to regroup and defend her home. After all, Lysander might have ships and docks, but what he won't have is helium. However, that's not quite the end of their negotiations. Lysander requests two oracles and Ajax's head, but hey, at least he agrees to trade Kevex for Cicero.
As the last Republic ship leaves Phobos, Lysander hosts the battle honors, rewarding a red from Gamma with a Loon Falera and the promise to make the severely wounded man whole, and giving Pytha the Civic Crown, the highest decoration he can bestow. The Golds receive custom razors, but Lysander himself chooses not to receive any honors. They then topple the statue of Darrow and hold a party, though Lysander is too busy mourning Ajax and thinking about their next steps to enjoy himself. He tells Julia Albalona that he wants to launch an iron rain on Mars in just 3 days, but also insists that they must have a better relationship with the Rim. Dido agrees with Lysander, even admitting that Diomedes has been championing him, at which point Lysander goes to find his friend in the gardens. But just as we're having what seems to be another everything's coming up Lysander moment, his eyes start bleeding! What the what? Okay, what the what is that he's been poisoned? And as Kyber disappears to find help, but Diomedes asks what he could do, Lysander withdraws into himself, feeling nothing but the agony and loneliness caused by a poison named the Lament. And as Lysander's celebration is cut short, Virginia's seems to be just starting as she receives a call from the Archimedes. She is overwhelmed to be seeing and talking to Darrow and makes sure to give him the good news first. Pax is safe, the important people are alive, and his friends who were on the trash droid made it back to Mars. Unfortunately, she also has to admit that she surrendered Phobos to Lysander and that there's no safe passage back to Mars. Not for him, not right now.
Instead, Virginia has other orders for him, to find Quicksilver and return at the head of his armada if it does in fact exist. Obviously, Darrow wants more than anything to return home, but he agrees to his sovereign's request, then brings Cassius and Severo in to hear Virginia out, because he knows Severo would not accept this news from him. Darrow isn't certain that he will be able to convince or even make Quicksilver return to the war, so he tells Virginia about Athena's offer to Severo. She reminds him that he, of all people, can't go to Ilium, not after what he did to secure peace with Romulus, but he avoids outright telling her he won't go, and as he's trying to give her a message for Pax, their communication is cut off. And so the Archie moves away from Mars and toward the belt, while back on Phobos, Lysander is awakened from an induced coma to some bad news of his own. Not just that he shouldn't have been woken up for at least 9 more days in order to make a proper recovery, but that his recovery was cut short because the Rim is abandoning them to return home, where Fa and his combined Obsidian Askamani forces recently took out the Ilium Guard and are surely on the path of full-on war against the Rim. But Diomedes has more than just bad news. He also has a request. He wants Lysander to sail with them, and in return, they'll give him the Shield of Akari, a military honor not given to a core gold since Lysander's ancestor Selenius died. Lysander's core allies don't think he should go, but Lysander insists. And so he, Rhone, and 9 other Praetorians board Helios Aulux's ship, while the rest of his forces and some of his friends lumber along behind on the Lightbringer to eventually meet up with Lysander in the Rim.
Virginia's in top form with her comebacks in the parlay with Lysander, although I want to step back a second and say the important people, that the important people survive, that's sort of rude, isn't it?
For us, well, the characters we know.
Yeah, yeah.
All the millions of dead are unimportant. I know where we're coming from now. Okay.
Important people with names. I mean, I'm not saying the little people are unimportant. Come on, don't put that on me.
We just don't know them. It's like we don't know that Johnny Red from Tunnel 5 survived. he's going back to his girl. Anyway. Where were we? Right. So the parley with Lysander, right? It throws Virginia a bit when Lysander shows off Darrow's razor hilt, the one she gifted him right after the Institute. But she has Darrow's statue to point to, which, of course, happens to be holding a sphere made from what sounds like figureheads from the prows of enemy warships. Only destroyer class and above, obviously.
Obviously. Virginia tells Lysander that is consistency against intense competition for 12 years now. One battle does not make you a lord of war. And she insists that he does not have her by the throat, but by the balls, as we mentioned, saying, "You can wrench and twist, and it will cause me terrible agony. But in the end, they are just balls, and I am a woman. So I will go on, enduring without my balls, and I will pester you to death by a billion cuts. Except it won't be me. I am not a captain who goes down with his ship. I am a sovereign who will delegate to people more suited for tunnels and darkness and the horrors that happen there." And by the way, she's talking about Rat Legion. Lysander doesn't. He's like, "Wait, what? They're all dead." And she's like, no. Yes, like you killed a ton of them on Mercury. But there were all these retired dudes who actually like did the stuff for the longest. And they're real mad now. So good luck.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm always going to see Lysander as a spoiled princeling because his whole drive for this is privilege, right? I want to restore the society because I'm the heir of Selenius. I'm an Auloon. It's my job to do this. I deserve to be in charge, right? By what metric? By blood? By the fact that you're a gold? Go sit and spin.
Yes, I completely agree. He is absolutely still an entitled spoiled princeling. But I think Virginia's opinion of that, I think it's more about how he looks. She didn't expect him to look like he had just come from war, maybe. She expected him to be like wearing all the trappings and not as humble, I guess, as he kind of was. Because he was kind of humble with her. It was like he was showing off, but he was also shy around her.
I think the thing is that when he meets Virginia, he's coming face to face with a legend. Her reputation is bigger than she is because of what she's done. He knows that, frankly, while she's right, he does have the upper hand, even though it might be in a lower place. Anyway, he does have the upper hand in this current strategic situation, but she's also a politician and statesman that he can't match. And so I would be a little trepidatious too. Lysander's weird. He's not arrogant enough to think that he can match her like Apple would be, but he is arrogant enough to assume that he has the right to do what he's doing. He walks a fine line. He's really like, I have the right to do this. I'm going to rule over everybody, but I also want to be a man of the people.
Yeah.
So it's like people deserve to be recognized for who they are, but gold is always on top.
Okay. So we should probably give at least a tiny bit of credit to Lysander for generally being respectful during this meeting, which I think we just did.
I'm glad I just listened to some of the previous episodes because now I know what my Lysander voice sounds like. So here we go. Although I will say it is not appropriate for this passage, but I'm nothing if not consistent. So here we go. Particularly when he tells Virginia, "I've known you almost my entire life. You've taught me some of my most cherished lessons. Chief among them, that we as a people need a language other than violence, or this war will never end. many ways, you and I are more alike than anyone else in this struggle. We were both raised in the shadows of tyrants and expected to be the same. But you are not Nero any more than I am Octavia. You proved it by spending my life all those years ago. Allow me to prove it now. And to be honest, he mostly does, considering he says she and her legions can leave Phobos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a compromise. The whole thing's a compromise on both their parts.
Oh, yeah. And nobody's happy with it, which is how compromises usually go. That's usually, you know, how they're working when nobody's really satisfied with what's happening. It's just the, you taught me that we need a language other than violence. Okay. And how have you tried to make your case to the Republic?
Yes, well, he despises the Republic. He doesn't think they're worthy of...
Like, what's he going to do? Is he going to kill every Republic citizen so that he could have his society? He's not making a very good case for the people. He's like, no, I come in peace. I'm not like those other golds. I'm a better gold. And I think
you bunch of bugs.
Yeah, you bunch of bugs. If I were an average Republic citizen of mid to low color, I'd be like, except that you're acting like all of the other golds. So,
well, when Virginia gets back to her side, she tells Victra that she has to give back Ajax's head. I laughed when I read it the first and second times, and I laughed as I was typing up the notes for this episode, because her response to Virginia telling her they have to give back Ajax's head is that, oh, but I was crafting a chalice for Sevro. It's just, it's great. It's great because I just imagine that she was already at work using acid or something to boil the skin off so that she could make a skull chalice for her husband for when he returns, which I love that about both of them, honestly, and their relationship, as grotesque as it kind of is.
If this were Ramsay Bolton doing this, you would be appalled.
Yes.
But it's okay because it's Sevredoya. To me, this is very disturbing either way.
I feel like that's a false equivalency.
Really?
Like, yes.
Yes.
Because, first of all, Ajax, as much as we in the last episode were talking about, okay, like he was kind of turning around a little bit, was still an awful person. And I'm not saying Victra is perfect by any means, but Ajax was terrible. Like, these are the good guys. So this is like...
I agree that it's extreme. And if I
understand that they're the good guys, relatively speaking. But are you a good guy if you're making chalices of your enemy's head?
I'm actually going to give Victra a pass on this one. And because what is good in life is to crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and hear the lamentations of their women.
Is that from Conan?
That's Conan, right? That's what is good in life. Now, I'm saying that Victra is definitely being barbarous at this point, but also she's been through some serious trauma. I do not think she's in her right mind right now.
So here's the thing. I think that comparing this to Ramsay Bolton is wrong. What I would compare this to is the Martells using Gregor's skull and making a chalice out of that.
I was as disturbed as that chalice also.
I wouldn't be, honestly. That's what I would compare this to. And I'm not saying that it's like that I would ever want to drink out of a real human skull personally. I just don't judge Victra for wanting to make Sevro one out of Ajax's.
I will say that Victra and Sevro do have a little bit of a Gomez Morticia vibe happening with them. But look, again, if I'm there, if this is a real thing that's happening and I am there watching this, she's getting some side eye from me. You know, I'm going to be like, is that really necessary? And then she's going to look at me with that look that says that I could kill you if I wanted to. And I'm going to be like, all right, okay, all right. I'm just saying, it's like that old joke, you know, you make one skull chalice, that's what you're going to be known for. I'm like,
I fucking love the Gomez Morticia comparison.
Yeah, and Electra is Wednesday, right?
Honestly, yeah. Now I kind of feel like that might be where Pierce took some inspiration from the Addams family for the Barca family here. Now, all that said, Victra is not too happy about having to give up the head that she was going to make into a chalice for her husband. But
trophy. It's a trophy.
Yeah. But then one of the men wheels Kavix in, and even Victra tears up. And this is just, thank fucking God, man. Not only is he still alive, he's back. We have a reprieve from the concern about Kavix's life for the moment. Anyway.
Lysander, meanwhile, is still playing politician, though this time with his own allies.
First, his big show of giving the Red, who's returning his cloak, the Falera, and promising to fix him up and give him whatever boon he requests. Does this not just reek of showmanship, or is that just me?
Again, it felt a little like, I'm a man of the people. Mm-hmm. The people love me. Here's the thing. They deliberately have Darrow mixing with all kinds of colors. You know, he's got obsidians. He's got a pink working as his director of intelligence. He's got reds. He's got greens. He's got blues. He's got all this stuff. Lysander has a couple of people who aren't his color and mostly hangs out with golds.
And even beyond that, the people who aren't his color who are actually close to him are all grays at this point. And Pytha, too.
And Pytha, yeah.
Right.
Pytha. And Glorastes, to be fair, but we don't know that Glorastes is still alive because Lysander did a thing.
But even then, Glorastes was considered the highest of the high with oranges, right?
Yeah.
He, what is it, like rubbed noses with golds all the time. So, and Pytha, while she isn't necessarily on that level, he did spend a lot of time with her. And she also was the captain of the Lightbringer. And what he did for Pytha, I do absolutely believe was something that he did from his heart.
Yeah.
What he did for the Red, while I do believe that he felt some things that he thought he was feeling while he was doing it, I do believe it was more like, I have to show these low colors that they will be rewarded too. And also, I feel like it's important to point out that this man is also a Gamma. I'm pretty sure all of the Reds that he had helping him with the quadrilles for this invasion were Gammas. So it's once again.
Yeah, but even more than that, it's like, and we're going to fix you up. I'm like, well, what about all the other people that have injuries this bad? Are you going to?
No.
It's like the Anakin and Padme meme. Mm-hmm. I'm going to fix this guy with bad injuries up. You're going to fix everybody with bad injuries up, right? Right? Silence. And then later during the party, Lysander tells Dido, I want your people to believe you're more than a utility. We take risks together and share the rewards together. I know your civilization needs a better source of helium. Privation need not be a way of life. I want Martian helium fueling a second age of prosperity in the rim. I want reforms here. He nods to the pinks. I want them to be shifted to the arts, not processed for consumption. I want more dignity, less violence, more law.
So he wants the pinks out of the brothel and onto the pole.
Well, here's my problem with that. He's still looking at a group of people and going, okay, let's get them away from what they're doing. This is great. I am firmly behind them. Let's not have a class of people that are sex slaves who are conditioned to not enjoy it.
Yeah, I'll give them that.
Yeah, great. But it's like, and now they're all going to do this other thing.
It's the same thing as the Republic did by pulling the Reds out of the mines and then being like,
It's like,
why now what do we do with you?
I don't know. Let them pick.
Yeah, they have to go into the arts.
Like, not everybody wants to do that.
The Republic issue was different because I don't think it was an issue that they pulled him out of the mines and now what do we do with you? The issue with the Republic issue was some of them left the mines, but regardless of whether they left the mines, you had this that they couldn't protect their own people was more the issue, I think, of why the Republic was having so many issues rather than the Reds out of the mines. There was also an issue of exploitation by the Silvers.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Very similar of the Soviet Union breakup and the oligarchs taking over.
But at the same time, you're bringing the Reds out of the mines and mining or silkworm farming or whatever the heck the women were doing. Those are the only two things they know. Many of them don't even know, most of them. I mean, shoot, Lyria was a Gamma and she doesn't know how to read. So you take them away from the only things they know how to do and tell them you don't have to do this anymore, but you don't have the jobs to give them.
Yeah, you
do, and so you just shove them into a camp unless they want to go to war, unless they want to fight, you shove them into a camp and you're like, we'll deal with this as best we can. Like, listen, I have my issues with the way the Republic handled things for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I frankly like to blame the problems of the Republic on certain colors being greedy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. That's absolutely part of it.
Yeah. Refusing to address a social responsibility. Yeah. Take the Reds out of the mines. Yeah. Give them schooling. Yeah. Give them training. Let them figure out where their interests lie and push them in that direction. Here you go. And don't, for the love of God, put everybody in a camp. Give them apartments. I don't care. House them. They deserve it.
Like, yeah. One thing I wanted to ask was, do we think by Lysander saying, I want reforms here, because he specifically says it that way, do we think he means he only expects to make them happen in the core? Like he's trying to placate the Rim goals.
It's tough to say. I think he's definitely saying, I want you to have prosperity. I want reforms here. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to be ignoring the core. The core needs some help. I don't know, because it does imply that perhaps those reforms won't happen in the Rim, but then again, you're setting yourself up for bigger problems in the future.
Yeah, which is exactly what Darrow did. Anyway, yeah. Moving on. Yeah.
When Lysander is poisoned, I'm sorry, let me enjoy that for a moment. And you know that there's no way this is how he goes, but you also have that, damn it, why couldn't this be how and when he goes thought?
We all knew it wasn't going to happen then. Right.
Well, but we suspected, but it's
like poison.
There have been books that have shocked us.
Yes. Pierce has not shocked us in that same way, though. We haven't seen the, oh, this character usually has this, like, what, they're dead. We haven't really seen a whole lot of that from him.
It was less than halfway through the book, I believe.
Yeah.
So and
halfway through book 3 of 4, he's not going out. We know that he's going to hang around like a bad smell.
Exactly. This is something that is just a personal thing that I wanted to mention. So we've all heard of a menu item like Ragnar's Vast Hunger, right? This is when Virginia has taken a menu. She doesn't know why she took this menu. She just wanted something from Phobos. And it's a menu from some restaurant, cafe, whatever. And on this menu is this Ragnar's Vast Hunger menu item. And it's a huge ice cream sundae with a whole bunch of toppings. And the menu that she picked up claims it's so big, it could only be finished in one sitting by Ragnar himself. But hey, if you can eat it all, it's free. So for me, it's the kitchen sink at Beaches and Cream at the Beach Club Hotel at Disney World. It's a giant ice cream sundae served in kind of a mini kitchen sink. It even has a fake faucet and everything. It has like several different kinds of ice cream, every single topping they offer at the restaurant. I never tried to eat it, but one of my friends did when we were all there one time. And I want to say back then it was like $30 or something, but that was a lot of money in 2002. My friend did not finish it. And did in fact get sick afterward. Have we all heard of a menu item like that somewhere? That's
going back to when I was a kid, Baskin Robbins had the Matterhorn, which was 7 scoops of ice cream and 7 toppings. And I believe if you could eat it all alone, you got it for free. But
there's a couple of things. There's Farrell's, which was an ice cream parlor out in Southern California. And I forget what it was, but they had the Avalanche, maybe, which was just what you'd expect, you know, a bunch of ice cream, of course. Possibly the most famous fictional one of these is the Ziggy Piggy from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, right, that Napoleon eats. But a couple of years ago, a friend of mine and I went to a place called Carmine's in D.C., and we got the Titanic. And let me tell you what that is. 6 scoops of vanilla and chocolate ice cream, wafer cookies, 2 caramelized bananas, strawberries, pineapple, hot fudge, and whipped cream. And the two of us tried to eat the Titanic. And that was a mistake. I know a lot of people talk about the meat sweats. You eat too much meat, you start getting the sweats. It's bad. We ate too much ice cream. I had to lay down for a long while.
I have to clarify here, just because, Jonathan, you said that the Matterhorn at this place you were talking about had 7 scoops of ice cream. The Beaches and Cream kitchen sink has 8 scoops of ice cream. Jesus fucking Christ. I'm not going to tell you the amounts of each thing because that would take too long. But it has, like I said, it has every topping they offer in the restaurant, which is fudge topping, butterscotch topping, peanut butter topping, 1 banana, cinnamon spice cupcake, angel food cupcake, chocolate syrup, marshmallow creme, strawberry topping, pineapple topping, an entire can of whipped cream, a brownie, 1 candy bar, 4 chocolate cookies, sliced toasted almonds, dark and white chocolate shavings, a tablespoon of crushed Oreos. They can't say that, but that's what it is. A tablespoon of jellied orange slices, milk chocolate chip morsels, peanut butter chip morsels, chocolate sprinkles, rainbow sprinkles, and maraschino cherries.
Okay, can we take a break now so I can go to the ice cream store?
It's absolutely ridiculous, but I remember reading it the first time and being like, I know we're going to talk about this on the podcast because I have to mention the kitchen sink and the fact that this is a thing.
Yeah, the problem with those desserts is that, I mean, really, they should all be named the Everest, because you look at it and you're like, because it's there. There's just such a temptation to be like, can I eat all that? Maybe I can. Maybe I should find out.
The funny thing is, as much as I love desserts and as much as I love ice cream, that actually doesn't sound appealing to me because a lot of those toppings things. I don't like.
Yeah. So, and I also want to say it's very funny that Jonathan, the one you mentioned was called the Matterhorn, and the one of the ones Seth mentioned was called the Avalanche. Like, what's the mountain theme going on here?
Well, it's cold and there's a pile of them. You know,
and this is Ragnar's vast hunger, which just, you know, the Valkyrie spires, etc. Anyway, moving on.
Yes.
Of course, Virginia has thought about Darrow before, but when she sees his face again after so long, she goes back to the very beginning of it all. Remembering when she looked down at two young men caught in a lock at the Institute. How romantic.
For Darrow and Cassius.
Oh! To AO3 to write the fic.
Yes. Oh, I haven't looked. I've never looked. I can almost guarantee you there are fics about Darrow and Cassius on AO3. Now that makes me want to look. So Virginia's opinion on Cassius isn't all that surprising, but wow, her thoughts about Darrow are something. She recalls, "There was Cassius, as distracting a man as has ever been made, but he was so used to drawing all eyes to him that he needed to be witnessed to spark. Then there was the other man, the Dark One, not in features, but dark in his energy. There was a man who needed no witnesses to burn. His energy was igneous and parthenogenetic, fire reproduced of itself. At first glance, I knew he was a powerful being with no manners, no airs, no grace, only a direction, one that ran straight through me. It wasn't love that he awoke in me, it was fear. But that is a part of love."
I gotta say, hard disagree on that one. I know what she's talking about. I'm going to make a leap here. I don't believe it is fear of Darrow.
No.
It is fear of what a relationship between them is going to be like.
Absolutely. From a femme perspective, I've been there where you meet that person and you're just like on fire for them. But you also know this person could literally be the end of me. Not in the literal sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, dangerous. Feelings.
Feelings. As a mask, I have never had that. I'm not going to say it doesn't happen for any mask presenting person, but I have just never felt that.
I have. Three times in my life.
Three times? That seems like a lot.
It's not even dangerous in that, oh, this person's obviously a bad boy sort of way.
No.
It's more like
intensity?
Well, yes. And I think as women were, and I say that as I identify as they, them, but as somebody who's raised as a girl, as a woman, we're supposed to be careful. We're supposed to be safe. And so meeting somebody who just awakens this thing in you where you're like, I both need to have this person and I'm afraid of the feelings I have for them. And I think that's kind of how it was with Virginia, right? It was dangerous then because she saw the magnetism he had for her and also recognized that there was other shit going on in there.
Yeah, it's also interesting that, let me go back to the line really quick. No grace, only a direction, one that ran straight through me. Like a lot of relationships, she knows well in advance of anything happening, but there is definitely from her that, oh, no, I know where this is going. I know exactly where this is going. I now have to figure out whether I could deal with that.
Well, and now they've been together for over a decade.
Unfortunately, it's definitely hard to hear Virginia tell Darrow he can't come home, even if her reasoning was sound.
And Severo obviously isn't happy with this turn of events, but let's be real. He has every right to be upset, even more so when he doesn't even get to talk to Victra.
I get why he couldn't, but still. As for Cassius, it's sweet when Virginia tells him it's nice to see him back where he belongs. Even if Darrow is feeling schoolboy resentment over her spending precious seconds on Cassius. I got to grow up.
Yeah, it's like you kind of want to take him aside and be like, let me tell you how much she just considered him a placeholder, my man. She had a good time with him, don't get me wrong, but there was never anybody for her but you.
I'm busy singing Hello Dolly in my head. Hello Cassius, it's so nice to have you back where you belong.
Anyway.
You're looking swell, Cassius. I can tell. Cassius. Okay.
Yeah. Red Rising musical.
I'm writing too many, Tara. I'm writing too many right now. I can't do this. Anyway, so Cassius's advice to Virginia about Lysander is interesting. It's just because he wants to keep his word doesn't mean he will.
Well, Cassius literally lived that, so.
Yeah, I mean, and we've seen that in other things, too, where I can't think of a specific example, but I know that I've read stuff where Lysander is like, yes, we're going to do this, and then because he doesn't actually have the juice to pull it off, he's got a Leo Grimaces or the Al whatever, whoever is like, no, 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 we're going to do another thing.
Even though Severo won't come out of his room and Cassius is drowning himself in wine, Aure brings out her lyra to play for them. And she's playing Hello Cassius.
Yes.
I like that. Except for the fact that it doesn't fit with what happens next. But Aure tells Darrow, I've never been so far from Io for so long. I find myself very homesick. It was Athena who told me there is no home for those born slaves, only a prison the master tricked you into calling home. The true home for a slave is in dreams, except on Mars, where slaves made our dreams real. I always found that a beautiful thought. Oh, which gives me chills even now, just like reading it again. But her song summons ghosts from Darrow's past, and he finds himself thinking of Ragnar, his father, Alexander, Fichtner, Io. I honestly avoided quoting this passage, not just because it's long, which it is, but it gets me all sorts of choked up. But at least later, when Darrow is in bed and watches Mars shrink in the distance, his hope doesn't diminish. When I was writing the notes for this episode, I looked over this passage like 3 times. I kept going back to it and be like, it's so long, but it's not that long. And then just, I don't think I could read it myself or even listen to it without just being like, Anyway, so they're on their way to the belt to find Quicksilver. Meanwhile, Lysander.
Yeah. Seems like Lysander's friends aren't all buddy-buddy with each other. Like, Roan isn't especially happy with Pytha and Cicero waking Lysander to tell him that the Rim forces are rushing home. But also, they can't take Mars without Atalantia or the Roths, so it's a damn good thing they did. Lysander. Not that taking Mars is on the table right this moment anymore, because Lysander is off to the Rim with Diomedes.
This whole chapter is a lot. There's a lot of things that happen. Roan kind of oversteps. I think Lysander doesn't necessarily see him overstepping with waking him up, but he oversteps later and then apologizes for it. We learn that Kyber has been hit by a sniper and is still alive. Then the Rim delegation, specifically Helios, is like, no, you're not bringing all of your like 1,000 Praetorians with us. You can pick 10 and the rest of them can just follow along on the Lightbringer. There's just a lot going on here. And, you know, Lysander is like, the pain, oh my God, Medusa's lament, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, it's pretty rough to be woken up and be in that much pain. And I don't really feel sorry for him, but it's still a lot to be woken up and be in that much pain and also have to face the fact that a good portion of your allies are leaving, rightfully so. And then you have to abandon all of your plans, such as they were, to go with them to prove that y'all are on the same side.
Well, there's honestly a lot going on that's sort of, I don't know, not that it's not reasonable for the Rim people to go back to the Rim, but there's a lot of maneuvering here right now that is Pierce making sure that all of his characters are going to be in the same place at the same time.
Well, at least he figured out how to do it.
Oh, shots fired, Groom. Anyway.
Yes, exactly. But also, though, I didn't really personally feel that this was all forced because we already knew that Fa had left Mars, as Jonathan says his name, had left Mars at the end of Dark Age. So we knew they were off somewhere, and it makes sense for them to go to the Rim because that's where the Ascomani are from. And this whole thing was maybe not always about taking revenge on the Rim for all the shit they've done to the Ascomani, but they had to get something out of it, the Ascomani.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the Rim makes more sense in the core. There's a lot of war fleets running around the core right now.
Yeah.
Don't want to try to raid those.
Whereas as Diomedes tells Lysander, it's like there's 2 armadas that are in the core and the shadow armada is like out in deep space or something. No matter who goes to take care of this, it's going to take them a long time to get there. So.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of space in space. Maybe force is the wrong word, but it definitely felt like setting up some pieces on the board. And again, these are reasonable, like these are good reasons to move them. It's not just fiat, but it felt like moving pieces around.
Yeah,
also,
for sure.
Could we have had more poisoned Lysander? I think we could have. I could have done with another few chapters of Lysander being poisoned. I would have taken a Lysander chapter that was just 3 pages of, that would have been great.
Well, that leads us right into the last bit.
And now it's time for In Memoriam.
Of our hopes that Lysander would have died from that poison. Seriously, really though, there were no new deaths.
Except for all the people that you said were unimportant.
No, they kind of died in the last section anyway. So.
And we can't name them. Okay.
Yeah.
In memoriam to all the people who died on Phobos.
Yeah, there we go. But also our hopes that Lysander would have died from that poison.
Yeah, oh, man.
All right. As we close out the episode, just want to give a shout out to our heroes, to our patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. Thank you so much for supporting us. Once again, I'm Tara, along with fellow host Jonathan and practically permanent guest host Seth. Don't forget that you can always hit us up at Sagas and Sass on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or email us at sagasandsass@gmail.com with any comments or thoughts you might have. Our next episode, titled Voltfas, will cover Darrow and Lyria's POVs from Chapter 37 to Chapter 42 in Part 3 of Lightbringer. Please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to our recordings.
Thank you for listening to the Sagas and Sass podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Sagas and Sass.